On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk about college angst with Breaking Away and Fandango.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week on the show, we have College Angst, which is, you know, kind of a coming of age movie of a different kind.
Yeah, it's not quite teenage angst. It's not like about high school or like or anything like that, or like, or like, you know, your prom date or your first crush or anything like that. It's about that kind of weird transition you go through when you're either about to enter college or you're leaving college, and your life is really going to fundamentally change because you're not really a kid anymore. You're actually a true adult. That kind of transitional period between being a young person to being a full-fledged grown-up.
And there's not a lot of movies in this sort of category, this sort of coming into adulthood. And, you know, because it's really kind of hard to pin down. And I think every, you know, sort of generation kind of goes through their own a way of dealing with it. But we have, and even these two movies that were made, were sort of almost period films. Mm-hmm. As they look back at the sort of the 1970s, in that transition period, you know what I mean? So anyway, let's just go ahead and get to it. So Breaking Away, is a movie. It was directed and produced by Peter Yates.
Mm-hmm. Peter Yates has made a lot of good movies.
Yes. And he actually, point of reference, he used his clout from the adventure film The Deep to raise and finance for Breaking Away. So this is the first movie that he produced. The budget was only $2.3 million, and the runtime is a nice 101 minutes. So, yeah, but, just a little bit over an hour and a half.
Both these films were brisk this episode, which I appreciate. It's someone who watches a lot of movies, you know.
Yeah, it's really nice to watch and really we'll get into it. But there's not a lot of scenes I would cut from either one.
No, hardly at all, really.
Yeah,
because they both are very kind of focused in what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
Like even though they're in a way they're both kind of hangout films, they still are very kind of on track the entire time. There's not a lot of pointless tangents.
Yeah. Yeah, and you kind of like, even at first, even if they're a little bit slow, you know, they really just kind of move you along to go, you know, what is this really about? Like, what, this is kind of weird. Like, this isn't, you know, this is a little different. This is a little skewed. And you're kind of like along for an adventure of sorts. So go ahead.
I was gonna say, the way I feel about it, it's like you're hanging out with these characters in both films.
Oh yeah,
it's like you're part of their crew, because both these movies have kind of crews of young men who are kind of in these transitional periods, and it's like you're kind of along on their journey as one of their, you know, members basically.
Yeah, you're kind of like a fly on the wall, but also kind of a member at the same time. It was written by Steve Tesch. I think I was pronouncing his name correctly. T-E-S-I-C-H. He was a Serbian American and undergraduate from Indiana University, with a in Russian of all things, and also a member of the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity. So, just to give you a real quick breakdown in the actual movie from IMDb, Dave and his working class friends Cyril, Moocher, and Mike spend their post high school days in Bloomington, Indiana, sparring with snooty students from the local university, chasing girls, and in Dave's case, dreaming of competitive bicycle racing. The four friends face opposition from all corners as they decide to make Dave's dreams come true in the university's annual bicycle endurance race. So you get very early on that Dave is like very obsessed with, you know, racing bicycles and this, you know, kind of like Italian bicycle racing team.
Yeah, like he's not just obsessed with like bicycle racing. He's obsessed specifically with Italian bicycle racing.
Yeah, like he speaks with an Italian accent, you know, around his parents and listens to, you know, Italian operas while he's, you know, taking a shower and things like that. Like it's just completely odd behavior.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of nowadays is we all have we all know at least one person who's really into British things. Like they watch British sitcoms, they listen to British comedians, they're really into like stuff on the BBC. And sometimes they may even use like British slang when you know they're not actually from, you know, the UK. Yeah. And so that's the closest equivalent I can think of to this for what we have nowadays. Basically, it's basically a kid who just kind of dreams about being something more than what he is. And yeah. He kind of focuses that into being this kind of Italian character.
Yeah, like even at one point he does the like the Catholic sort of you know cross or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know his mom
you can tell
is like,
we're not religious on this podcast.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called. It's Catholic. He's like, oh, don't you start going Catholic on me, you know? And you know while his dad is just trying to figure out like what am I gonna do with the boy? Like what am I gonna do? It's almost like this failure to launch because he doesn't really have. You get the idea. He doesn't really have a job or got fired from his job or quit. You know the ringleader of the group. This has a kind of I don't want to say an all-star cast, but I was just surprised.
It's got a pretty great cast.
Pretty fantastic cast. You have a young Dennis Quaid as the kind of the ringleader of their group. Goes by Mike. And then also a Daniel Stern from City Slickers and Home Alone. Like, this is his very first movie.
It was his very first film, huh? Yeah, he certainly looks young. And Moocher is played by someone who our listeners will know, Jackie Earle Haley, who was in the Bad News Bears, the original Bad News Bears. He was in the Watchmen, the film adaptation of Watchmen. He was in the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yep.
He's in a lot of things.
He was
he's a very popular character actor.
And some of our fans may know him as the Terror in the new the Amazon series, The Tick.
That's true. I love that show, and I'm sad it's been canceled. So that, but that's a good point. He was the Terror in that as well.
Yeah.
And,
so I mean, but
he's great. Yeah.
Yeah. He started off as a kid actor. So and then the main character by a guy by the name of Dennis Christopher, who plays Dave. But also Paul Dooley plays Dave's dad, Ray Stoller, and this is a guy. His character actor has been in several films. He's in Strange Brew. He's most notably Molly Ringwald's dad in 16 Candles.
That's true. I knew I recognized him from somewhere.
Yeah, he also is the voice of Sarge in the movie Cars.
Huh.
Yeah.
That I did not know. That's pretty neat.
Yeah. So, amazing film about, you know, what life was sort of like in the 70s in Bloomington, Indiana, where you have these young boys and the other people call them, the people in the town call them cutters. And when I first heard that term, I thought, what are they like cutting class or something like that?
Yeah.
Or, and one of the characters, like one of the you know, sort of the antagonist, you know, girlfriends, said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, you just have to kind of be from around here. To know. But what you get, you finally get the idea that they're stone cutters. They're Indiana, like, limestone cutters. They're like just the blue collar, you know, sort of workers of the town.
Yeah, because that was the industry. There was rock quarries. And so they're basically the children of the people who basically mined and cut the stone that a lot of the town is built out of, most of the university. So the university kids look down on the townie kids, and that's just that they're kind of, it's probably a derogatory term that started, you know, 40 years before the movie happened, and the kids just kind of perpetuate it without really knowing why they called them that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Indiana, you know, limestone is as, you know, is super popular. Like, anybody should know how fantastic Indiana limestone is. It's synonymous with, like, Texas, you know, oil or something like that. You know what I mean? It's what the state is known for. You know what I mean?
Truthfully, I didn't know that. So you're learning things here on the Video Culture Podcast, or at least I am.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what the state of Indiana is really known for. You know, that is their main sort of thing, just like Michigan is known for, you know, producing cars and things like that. So, yeah. But these are the stone cutters, the ones that actually, like, did the, you know, did the work or whatever. And Dave is just sort of, like, struggling along. He really is a really great, you know, fantastic, like, bike rider. But he's not, you know, you get the idea that he, you know, is not smart enough to, or maybe have the money to go to university or whatever and be a part of the team.
I get the impression he's not motivated. Like, he loves competitive bike riding, and that's what he loves. That's what motivates him. And he's not motivated by going to school.
Yeah.
Like, they establish very early on that he is a award-winning competitive cyclist.
Right.
Like, they actually introduce him, showing him biking home from a race, carrying a trophy. He's clearly really good at cycling, but how do you turn cycling into any kind of thing that supports you as a career?
Right.
That's kind of the place where he's at, where the one thing he's really good at, the one thing he's gifted at, you can't really make a living doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least not back then, like, that it wasn't like, you know, because he's like super obsessed, like dressing like these people, having posters. I mean, most kids, you know, probably had movie posters. He's got posters of this, you know, very obscure Italian, you know, racing team who, like, races in the Tour de France and stuff like that. So, you know, it's very, you know, very sort of interesting because, you know, this is a time period. Like, we now know, like, we know the Tour de France because we've had, Lance Armstrong and things like that. Like, we've been kind of a part of it, but as America, you know, back then it was just seen as very European, like a European type sport.
Yeah. And they call his very normal looking bicycle to us. They call it a weird bicycle more than once in the movie.
Yeah.
And literally it's just a competitive cycling bicycle.
Yeah.
You've seen it 1,000 times nowadays, but back then it was seen as pretty unusual.
Right, and he's wearing a hat that says, like, Campanago or whatever, which is the biggest, you know, manufacturer of, like, the, you know, pedals and gears and things like that for bicycles, derailleurs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's really only odd because of what time period he's living in.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Like, now it's very commonplace to see those bikes, to see those kind of racing bikes and have those down tube shifters and stuff like that. But back then, you know, you just had, there were no shifters. There was just, you know, you just had the one gear and that was it. You know what I mean? But there's this huge struggle. And to me, I thought this movie, and I don't know about you, but I felt it was almost two or three movies kind of in one, where you kind of have the same sort of thing, and it's really funny because it's almost like movies that we've just watched, because I felt like it was like, you know, the rich people from the town versus, like, the poor people of the town.
Yeah.
Just like we had in The Outsiders, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Where instead of...
Definitely I had a little bit of that, yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, instead of greasers and socias, it's like, you know, the Cutters
and the college kids,
the fraternity people, you know, the frat guys. And then you also had the ending where it was like you have this race, and it was almost like kind of like this Bad News Bears or like Dodgeball, you know, whatever, where it's like, you know, they have to win. They have to, you know, they're the downtrodden, you know, kind of.
Yeah, it's an underdog sports movie. Exactly. Yeah. But I think it all works well. I think it works pretty well together because so much of it is just a slice of life movie. I mean, it's not really about any of those things. It's kind of just a section of these kids' lives.
Right. And then you're just kind of right, because then there's also like the underlying story of like the father and like how he's reconciling with his, you know, son who's growing up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The way he kind of how he comes to terms with it, basically.
Yeah.
How he starts to see his son's value, not through what he wants him to be, but through what he actually is.
Exactly.
But it's all just kind of gentle. None of it feels really forced. I mean, some of the humor is a little forced with the father and the son.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's just kind of a real kind of, again, fly on the wall. You're just kind of watching these people live their lives. It's like you're hanging out with these Cutter kids.
Yeah.
Throughout them, you're watching them in their lives. You're going to the quarry with them as they have a swim. You go with them to have pizza. You're there when they get into scraps with the frat boys, or when one of them falls in love with a girl on the college campus.
Yeah.
You know, you're just kind of spending time with them, observing their lives, and it's all just frankly pretty enjoyable because it's very well acted. It's not overly melodramatic, and it's all very relatable. Like, if you've ever been that age, you completely know what these guys are feeling, even though it's something that takes place in 1979.
Yeah. Completely true. Completely very true. So I don't know how to follow that up, really. I mean, seriously, you always... you know, hit the nail on the head and say almost exactly what I'm thinking.
That's sweet of you to say, brother.
Yeah.
But let's do the thing we've started to talk about, and if you were gonna fast forward through any part of Breaking Away, what part would you fast forward? What part could you do without?
Well, first off, I don't think either one of these movies, I wouldn't cut out a scene. Okay. However, because it's so difficult to watch, and I almost didn't like it. It was almost like too harsh. But when he's like racing against his like favorite, you know, Italian racing team, they're all together and they decide to just, you know, they're like, they're not going to let a kid beat them. So they intentionally wreck him.
Yeah, like this kid's obviously just in awe of them and wants to be near them, and
he does nothing but idolize them, and they try to talk to them. Yeah,
and they trash him. Yeah, it's harsh. That's a hard scene. I think that's something we all go through as kids when we realize sometimes the people that we look up to aren't really worth looking up to.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody has a moment like that in their lives. Maybe not as dramatic, but I think we all go through that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's necessary in the movie because it's one of those things that really turns the character Dave around to go, you know what, I'm going to have to be serious about, you know, this kind of stuff. And, you know, after that, he takes down the posters and takes down the stuff and, you know, has a heart to heart with his dad and stuff like that. But it was just a really hard scene to watch because you want that scene to be like, you want him to be the underdog and just like take it all. You know what I mean?
And you kind of want him to be accepted because that's clearly what he wants. And he's not. And
like, he's not accepted by his dad. He's not accepted by the town. He's not accepted, you know, almost by his friends because he's, you know, he's not even
they don't quite understand his weird Italian obsession either.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, but to me, the part of the point of the story is, and again, to go back to the idea of growing up and becoming a man, he has to learn that he can't pretend to be somebody else. He's got to learn to be okay with who he is.
Yeah, like so, he picked up the girl like as a like he's an Italian foreign exchange student or something like that.
Yeah, and he realized in the end that if he had just been himself, he would have been just as successful if he had just believed in who he was and not tried to put on an act.
Yeah,
and I think again that's something a lot of young people go through as they're trying mm-hmm. to figure themselves out. They'll try on personas,
mm-hmm.
and this is just kind of an extreme example of that.
All right, what scene would you rewind and watch again?
Let me tell you which scene I would cut out
because okay.
mine's different than
sorry.
Yours.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a little moment, but man, it was awkward to me because as I was watching it, there's a scene at the very end, like the kid wins the race, everyone's celebrating, you know, he reconciles with his parents, you know, Dennis Quaid reconciles with his older brother, and Mooch, you know, hugs his girlfriend or wife. Because he gets married
yeah,
in the
right?
film.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene where awkward Daniel Stern, just kind of looks around and there's no one there to like be like, hey, good job or congratulations.
Yeah.
And it lingers on
him. Yeah.
And it lingers on him for like 30 seconds of him just kind of looking around. And it's clearly, I don't think they intended it to be awkward,
mm-hmm.
but it is super awkward because he clearly has no one who's like, good for you, man. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Like
and I would totally trim that out. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's really all. It's just a brief moment. It's really off-putting.
Yeah, it's true. And I think, you know, not to be a disservice to Daniel Stern, I just think the way his character was written, you know, didn't really have a lot of, you know, aspirations or... You know what I mean? He was just kind of the naysayer of the whole group. And well, so, yeah, and then they win, and it's kind of like, okay. But, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying there. That was kind of weird. Because he didn't have anybody to hug. Like, Dave's hugging his parents. And then, like, yeah, the other guy's hugging. He's like, where do I do? You know?
It was just weird. Like, why couldn't they all just, like, hugged him at that moment. They all could have ran over to him and like hugged him in like a group friendship thing.
Yeah.
And that part, like I said, that part bothered me. But it's like 30 seconds of the entire movie.
Yeah, it's a last little bit. Yeah.
So as far as the scene that I think is really phenomenal is something that you don't see a lot in sports movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last lap of the race. The last lap of the big race is shown in real time. And it's all one continuous shot. So you literally see them begin it and in it and end it. And you see the hero win.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a very nice way to do it. Because it showed that, you know, real sports and real moments can be just as dramatic as anything that, you know, quick cutting and fancy editing can do. I just really admired the confidence of doing that whole sequence in one shot from a distance. Just to let you see it as if you were watching from the stands. I really like that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention, is that shot was, you know, from the fan, you know, in the stands perspective. And I never really even thought about that at all. That never even crossed my mind. So once again, that's just like an awesome observance, because in that last lap is so tense, you know, as he's trying to catch up and pass, you know, make that final pass. I never even thought about that at all. Great scene. Obviously it's the kind of the wrap up of the movie and things, but, I'm trying to think of what scenes that I would want to watch again. You know, the scene where they're all like hanging out at the quarry.
Like the way the movie begins.
Yeah, you know? Where they're all talking about, you know, like, hey, you know, we all got fired. Like, no, you got fired. We all quit and protest.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, and he talks about how he, you know, wants. I think that was another scene where he talks about he wants to smoke. But yeah, just the camaraderie where he's and also, oh no, I take that back. Now that I think about it. The scene, the beauty scene where he's like riding around in his bike and, you know, the girl comes and passes him in the car or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
But I guess I do love those quarry scenes because, to me, those ring so true to the idea of youthful friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're those kind of friendships you have when you're that age that you just... It's kind of sad to think about, but you don't really have those ever again.
Yeah.
And you don't think about it at the time, but eventually, you know, you get married or, you know, your job keeps you busy or you have children or sometimes all three of those things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Moocher talked about that, you know what I mean? And Mike, you know, who's Dennis Quaid, you know, was just like, well, shut up. And you know, Moocher's like, well, it's going to happen. Like, we're not always going to hang out together.
Yeah. Well, and definitely Jackie Earl Haley's Moocher, like, character kind of understood. Like, he was kind of thinking about the future because he had fallen in love already. He was already starting to kind of move away.
Right.
And everyone has that kind of – everyone has a group of friends. And there's always that one person who's kind of the first person to sort of break away, if you will.
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, I think that's, like, the idea of breaking away, breaking away from childhood, becoming adult, breaking away from, you know, like your group of friends and, you know, coming into your own sort of adulthood. And then also the, you know, breaking away from the pack, you know, in bicycle racing. So, you know.
Yeah. It represents, so that phrase represents a lot for sure.
Yeah. Also, I failed to mention in the cast, John Astin plays Mike's brother. We all know John Astin from Beverly Hills Cop.
I did not recognize him.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. That is him. He's the lieutenant from Beverly Hills Cop. He's Taggart.
I completely didn't recognize him, but I believe you. I didn't realize him.
Yep. And Amy Wright, who played Moocher's wife, Nancy, she was actually married to Rip Torn. She married Rip Torn in 1989 up until his passing.
Oh,
yeah.
So I have to ask you, had you seen Breaking Away before this?
Never. Not even parts of it.
I never had either, and I really enjoyed it.
I seriously really enjoyed it a lot. I mean, at first I watched it, and it kind of like, I was like, oh, this is kind of like this movie, or this is kind of like this movie. I don't know if I really like it. But then the more I thought about it the next couple of days, I'm like, and it was really good, and that was when 1979, this is before stuff like Revenge of the Nerds. This is, before this idea of, like, this, you know, sports, you know, ending where it's like the underdog story and stuff like that. And I think that if you really go back, you know, I think a lot of other movies sort of copied it a little bit or took parts of it that they liked about it.
Well, yeah, even like the beat of that, they get their own little like team uniform at the end, right before the big meet, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a lot of those like sports underdog moments there at the end.
Yeah.
That are really now just tropes, you know, 40 years later.
Well, and yeah, like the Bad News Bears, you know, and that sort of thing. I mean, it's, you know, or the Mighty Ducks or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I really thought about, you know, how much this parallels, you know, Revenge of the Nerds almost, where it's kind of like, you know, these guys get beaten down by the other frat guys, but then they wound up, you know, beating them in the competition at the end, you know, and that's what their big, you know, moment was or whatever, you know what I mean? It's, kind of the same thing. And then they also have to be, you know, like, a, you know, sort of like adults, you know what I mean? They can't just be like it. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely enjoyed it too, and I had never even heard of it. You know, I know it's, I don't like to admit for that, but I never heard of it when you brought it up, and I was like, I didn't even know anything about it. So I watched it cold, and I was pleasantly surprised by it. I found it really enjoyable.
Yeah, I did too. I really, you know, and being from the South and that sort of thing, and going to college to have that experience, and so yeah, it was really really interesting. To watch. So now we're going to move on to Fandango. Now, this is a movie that I had seen and you haven't seen. I watched this movie, like, it probably came on, like, you know, TNT or TBS or WG, you know, one of those, like, type of, you know, because it was not a big commercial success movie, and so it was one that was like, oh, this is something that WGN could fill time on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock when there's not a Cubs game on, you know. So it was kind of like that kind of thing. And it is a movie that was directed by Kevin Reynolds, who also directed Robin Hood, Prince and Thieves, Waterworld, The Count of Monte Cristo. He was the original writer of Red Dawn, who we talked about on the show before. We don't know exactly what the budget is, but it was probably really low. So the synopsis, I'll read right quick. It's 1971 at the University of Texas, Austin. College buddies facing graduation, marriage, and the draft skip out on their own graduation party and head to the Mexican border for some adventure, a buried secret, and one last go-round at, quote-unquote, the privileges of youth. And that was written by Scott Butler on IMDb, and it stars a very young Kevin Costner as the lead role, Gardner Barnes. It also stars Judd Nelson and a bunch of other sort of unknowns. Sam Robards is Kenneth Wagner. Chuck Bush plays this guy named Dorman. So, but yeah, this is Kevin Costner's sort of like breakout role, like his first, big screen debut.
Yeah, it wasn't his very first movie, but it was his first like big movie to get released.
Yes.
And man, you could tell he was going to be a movie star from like moment one.
Yes.
Like he has screen presence in this. He's honestly, I always forget sometimes that these established actors used to be young.
Mm-hmm.
So like he's just young and cool.
Yeah.
You know, he's got kind of that quiet kind of James Dean cool about him, and his character actually idolizes James Dean in the film, but he really kind of nails that kind of, that kind of aloofness.
Yeah, and the kind of like the don't care attitude, like things will all work out, no matter what. Like, and he's really sort of the thing that keeps the party going, like the thing sort of going. You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, just to kind of set it up there, even in the opening scene where they're at this college party, and it looks like, something out of Animal House, right? But it's like graduation, and this rinky dink little house, and there's like everybody in there, and they're trying to surprise one of the guys, which is Kenneth Wagner, and they, because he's about to get married, because as soon as he, graduates, he's going to go off to Dallas, Texas to go get married. And, he comes in and they go, yeah, surprise. And he's like, no, everybody be quiet. Like the wedding's off. And, right when he says it, Kevin Costner kind of gets this little kind of happy smirk for half a second. And it's real quick. And if you don't watch, like you almost miss it. Mm-hmm. And it's like kind of quiet, but you kind of go, he's almost happy about this. Like there's something going on. And,
and you can kind of just think it's because he wants them all to stay together. That's what you think anyway in the beginning. Yeah,
exactly. And it's not revealed until the very end that, the reason why is because he had a history with, the bride to be, and he's still kind of in love with her. You know what I mean? So
The structure of it's actually really, it's built really interesting. But also the character mentions the other characters, he's calling off the wedding, says he called off because he's been drafted. Because he didn't graduate from college, he didn't qualify for graduation. And after 3 years with no, academic advancement, he qualifies for the draft because this movie takes place in 1971 when the Vietnam War was still ongoing. I mean, it was kind of starting to wind down, but it was still a thing.
Right. And you could still get conscripted and your number could come up. Yeah.
And also Kevin Costner's character is like, well, I've been drafted too. So I guess that means we've got one last weekend to really have fun before things get dark.
Yeah.
And he basically drags all his friends, this group of buddies he has they've kind of nicknamed themselves the Groovers, like they're all in the groove.
Right.
And he basically convinces them to go on a road trip to Mexico to find Dom.
No, to dig up Dom.
To dig up Dom.
To dig up Dom.
D-O-M.
Yeah. So we got to go. Hey, now, you know what this means? We got to go dig up Dom, which basically means they're going to have one last hurrah. They're going to have one last drive to their favorite bar that's just across the border. You know,
one last crazy adventure.
Yeah.
And the movie actually starts with the definition of the word fandango. And one of the sub-definitions of fandango is a foolish act.
Yeah, because it's like a dance is what it, like this whole like thing. And then, yeah, the second part, like the B part, is like a foolish act or whatever.
And he even says as they're running to the car, he goes, one last fandango.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And really, it becomes like this really comical road movie. Like you would think a movie about like kids kind of living in fear of the draft would be really dark or kind of somber, and it's really not. It's a very kind of like happy, laid back road movie about, again, just spending time with your friends. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, that kind of lightness of youth.
Yeah,
like they use the phrase "the privilege of youth." The idea that you're young and you're at a point where nothing really matters, so you can just be free and have fun.
Yeah,
and that's such a fleeting, wonderful time in your life that you don't even realize is wonderful until you're many years past it. So it's a very nostalgic movie in a way too. But it's got lots of little fun asides, or like they run out of gas at one point and they try to rope their car onto a train so the train will pull their car because it's out of gas, and it pulls the front off their car, and you know, ridiculous like things only kids would try to do to overcome obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fun movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have the three sort of main characters, right? You have Kevin Costner's playing Gardner, Judd Nelson's playing Phil, which Judd Nelson in this movie is really kind of like this ROTC kind of dork, right? He's the one who's telling them, you know, no, this is my car. No, we need to turn around. No, we need to go back. Like, he's kind of being the party pooper. And he's kind of trying to tell him, like, no, you need to serve your country and you need to, you know, have some responsibility and all this kind of stuff. And he's the one trying to hold back the party, really. And they're, you know, just like, you know, picking on him. And then Sam Robards, I mean, he's the kind of guy who's just kind of going along with it. Like, he doesn't really know what to do, but he's just going along because, you know, it's the thing to do or whatever. And then the other two guys, even though that they're there, you know, Dorman is just like, you know, he's just like a fixture. The other two guys are just kind of fixtures because one guy, the Dorman, doesn't really say much, and the other guy's just like passed out the whole time.
Yeah. Dorman is kind of is this kind of big, burly, kind of like, he's kind of like, everyone has that one friend who's really kind of big and burly but is really a sweetheart. That's this character, and he's really the character who has it the most together in the entire, like, if you watch it, like, he doesn't have a lot of lines, but this big burly dude who you think would be like angry or like their bruiser is really the most centered, calm, and together of the entire group. And you get the impression he's the one who has the most about his life figured out.
Well, like, you've seen him, like, in every scene, he's reading a book of some kind. And then it's also revealed, at, you know, at the beginning of the movie that he, you know, is going back home to become, like, a minister or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of the film, you actually get to see him acting as a minister, but we'll get to that. And he, that's kind of his role in that, because everyone has a friend who just, again, kind of had it all together. You know, like, not everyone struggles with their path in life. Some people are just kind of lucky enough to know who they are and know where they're going to go, and that's kind of personified in this character. Like, he's the most together, he's the most calm, and he's really the most capable. He just chooses not to lead, because not everyone's a leader.
And, you know, and they get some of these, like you said, like the side stories, like they run out of gas, and then they have to push their car into the next town, and then they wind up, like, you know, Gardner turns on his charm to the cute girls at the Sonic, you know, and they get to, you know, hang out with them and, you know, go shoot off fireworks at the
graveyard,
the cemetery, and which turns into kind of a, you know, kind of a moment, or or whatever that you would, of Vietnam or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it makes me kind of remember for a moment what they're avoiding.
Yeah,
as will often happen, you know, you'll try to avoid things and suddenly you'll think about it again.
Right. And then there's this whole, it's a huge side story where basically Phil gets dared to, you know, parachute out of a plane.
Yeah, they're driving along and they see a place that are offering same day skydiving lessons.
Yeah,
and they keep bragging Judd Nelson's character about how he's actually a coward and he's a weenie, a quote unquote weenie.
Yeah,
and he's like, I'm not. And they're like, well, if you're not, let's see you prove it.
Yeah. So they stop and they meet the most zaniest, you know, like hippie character named Truman Sparks. And what a character he is.
Yeah, he's the parachute instructor, and he's like this typical like hippie burnout character, but he's got a lot of fun little quirkiness to him. Like it's hard to convey comedy in this situation, but yeah, his scenes are hysterical.
Yeah,
it's almost like a little sub movie within the movie.
It's almost like, you know, he kind of plays like, you know, like the stoner. He's like this really tall, lanky, you know, kind of redheaded guy, you know, and he's, you know, it's kind of almost like your pizza delivery man is going to push you out of a perfectly good plane. And even really, I wouldn't even say perfectly good. That plane was really like kind of rinky dink, you know, plane.
Yeah. There's a concept of how he keeps duct taping the plane together.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really fun sequence because they go through all this thing of basically Judd Nelson trying to get a crash course in like skydiving from this like space case, and his friends are just laughing at him the entire time. And then when he goes up into the actual plane,
don't ruin it.
Oh, you don't want me to ruin it?
No.
Okay. No. Okay. I won't.
There's a lot of people that have not seen this movie.
That's true. That's true. It is an undiscovered movie.
No spoilers for this movie.
Yeah, I won't spoil. We won't spoil how it ends. We won't spoil the skydiving sequence.
Yeah.
But it's really creative.
Yeah.
It's really funny, and you really have no idea what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I will say it's fun. It's poignant without being sappy.
Yeah.
Like I got to tell you, the entire time I was watching it, before I realized where it was going to go, I felt a little uneasy because I kept having like. I kind of felt like the characters were the idea of like Vietnam and the draft.
Oh yeah,
was always kind of in the back of my mind as I was watching it.
Yeah,
and I think I would even enjoy it more going back and watching it, knowing that that's not really something that plays too heavily into it.
Yeah, and it's kind of almost. I mean, the whole sequence is probably like 20 or 30 minutes long. When you start from start to finish, it's a big part of the movie. And it kind of plays into the ending a little bit because they use, you know, Truman, you know, later in the movie to kind of fly the bride to this other location for the marriage, for the wedding that's back on.
Yeah. And we don't necessarily want to spoil that because that's a really fun sequence too. And we normally don't care about spoilers, but Ryan's got a point. A lot of people have not seen Fandango, and it is worth discovering fresh if you can.
Yeah.
So yeah, all I'm going to say is I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to watching it again eventually.
Yeah,
and I'm so glad I got to see it without knowing anything about it.
Yeah, but my point being though is that it really sort of captures you. You almost forget that you're watching this movie with these guys that are on this journey. You know what I mean? It's almost like a separate sort of like movie within a movie kind of thing.
It really is like it's definitely an aside, but it's such a fun aside with the whole skydiving thing that it's almost
like an episode, like, you know, like you're like almost like a TV episode of these characters doing something else. You know, that's kind of what it is.
I'll go ahead and bring this up. I actually do a lot of the website prep for the show, and I get the poster art for these episodes, so I have to go through and look for the posters in advertising to make the thumbnails. And a lot of the advertising internationally for Fandango actually focuses a lot on the skydiving scene.
Yeah,
not so much in America. In America, it's all about, you know, the road trip and the desert in Texas. But like for like Europe and all that, it's all like wacky like plane stuff. It's kind of funny because it's that's not really the tone of the entire movie,
mm-hmm.
but the skydiving sequence is a huge focus of the marketing for every other part of the world.
Right. And not to disappoint anybody, but I just want to point out the fact that the song A Whiter Shade of Pale by the group Procol Harum, which the opening lyrics to that song is, "We skipped the light fandango." That song is not in this movie at all, but that's probably where you've heard like the name or you know, fandango. But that song has nothing to do with this movie whatsoever. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, I was surprised it wasn't in the movie, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you're almost expecting it to be, right? And they might have. I mean, you never know, because A Whiter Shade of Pale is about, you know, the girl that he couldn't get, right? The girl that he thought he was going to be with, and then she winds up, you know, skipping out on him. And, like, we had our fun times, but now our fun times are over, basically. You know what I mean? That's what that song is all about. And they might have planned on you know, using it, but they might not have got the rights to do it or whatever.
It's
couldn't
possible.
Afford it or whatever. You know what I mean? Who knows?
But, you know, the music that's in the soundtrack, though, is all pretty great. It's got a really great 70s soundtrack.
Yes. I think Steppenwolf is in it, right?
I believe so. Yeah, yeah. Born to be Wild. Yeah. Yeah. In one of the bigger sequences, it's got a lot of great 70s rock tunes in it.
Oh, for sure.
So I got to ask you, if you were going to fast forward through any part of Fandango, is there any part of Fandango that you would skip over?
I'm thinking, no. I would not skip over or delete like any sequence or any scene from that entire film. I adore this film from, you know, the first moment all the way to the very end. And you really almost don't feel like the movie ends when it does end, because it still is, like you said, like a slice of life kind of movie. You know what I mean? You still feel like these characters are still, you know, sort of going on or whatever, you know what I mean? It really doesn't have like a resolute kind of thing where they, you know, talk about like, oh, well, this guy, you know, after this did this, you know what I mean? It just,
yeah, he became president of the United States.
There's none of that. And I think that's perfect. You know, we don't need that. We just need it to end where it does. I don't.
Yeah, sometimes the ending is just when the credits roll, and I definitely agree with you. Thinking on it as I watched it for the first time and thinking back on it, like if I thought anything was weaker or out of place, I don't think I would trim anything out of it. Now, that's not to say I think it's the greatest movie ever made. I just think that it's so consistently good that I can't say that I would chop any part of it out. I don't think there's any obvious weak spots or anything that feels jarring or out of place, or that I just don't at least sort of like. So I'm in the same boat with you. I don't think I would fast forward through any of it. Now,
if I were to make, I will say this, and I thought about this, you know, because I knew this question was going to come up, and I'm trying to get more prepared for these questions.
Sure.
Is that if I were to make one change about the movie? When Judd Nelson's character, Phil Hicks, when he like gets into the plane and all of that, like I don't like the goggles that are on him, because we miss a lot of his facial expressions because of it. Cause he's already wearing a helmet. He's already wearing this stuff. And I know he looks ridiculous in the goggles, but the sort of the scenes, you know, as they go on, like we really miss a lot of that facial expression emotion from him. And I think that would probably be about the only change I would make.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely goes for it in that scene. Again, not to spoil too much of it, but he definitely swings for the fences in that scene for sure.
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, for Judd Nelson, while we're talking about it, I mean, here's a guy that played, you know, the cool guy, right, in The Breakfast Club. And here he's playing like a ROTC nerd, and he just, to me, has a lot wider range than I think people give him credit for. Because also he plays this like kind of sleazy guy, in St. Elmo's Fire. And it's just like, imagine sort of like Kevin Costner playing a sleazy guy. You know what I mean? It's just like, I don't really know. So, I mean, to me, I was just like, I know Kevin Costner was great and I've seen it, but now that I watch the movie and I'm older, I can appreciate like sort of the other actors as well and be like, you know what? That was a great performance.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened in Judd Nelson's career that he kind of fell from grace, but I always thought, especially during that time period, that he had a lot of good performances, and he showed a lot more range than he's given credit for, so I would totally agree with you. I would totally agree with you on that. I think he is underappreciated, for sure.
All right. And well,
so,
yeah, go ahead.
So what scene would you rewind and watch over again? What's your favorite scene? What scene do you want to savor from Fandango?
The wedding scene where the whole town is like kind of like together and they're all dancing and they're all sort of happy. I mean, the movie takes place only in the span of like 2 days. And you only get like two sort of like, it starts off at night and then goes through, you kind of get the idea that it's like Saturday and then like Sunday. And here it is like Sunday, you know, sort of like evening, and this whole town is celebrating these two people and just having a wonderful time just out of the blue. I think it just comes together just beautifully.
Yeah, I think I've got two very different reasons. To me, the most fun thing in the movie to me is there's a sequence with the plane and with the pilot near the end that is got a lot of really cool stunt work, and it's a good bit of comedy. It's also got some cool stunt work in it, so it's a really neat sequence that you really don't see in modern film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of great practical stunt work, and it's really nice and really enjoyable, and I like that scene a lot. But the one that strikes me the most emotionally, and the one I find myself thinking about, and again, not to go into any spoilers, but it's Kevin Costner's last moments in the film. And I'm not going to say anything else about it because I don't want to spoil where he ends up.
Mm.
But there's like where he's at the very end of the film, right before the credits roll.
Yeah.
What I found was so lyrical and beautiful, and it really resonated with me. And I was like, wow, that's poignant. And I really understood it, and it affected me in a really deep way.
Yeah.
So I love that scene.
Yeah. It ends like on the very like, perfect note of most any film I've ever seen. You know what I mean? It's just very capturing. Cause when you think about, you know, because it just puts the whole film and their adventure like all together, like in one about where all the characters were at that time. So, I mean, it's just, it might get dusty in the room a little bit, depending on how emotional you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The older I get, the more stuff like that affects me, for sure.
This blessed gust of wind just came through, I think.
Yeah, like I'm glad I saw it at this age where I could appreciate what it was trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was cool, you know, back then. I just thought it was a cool movie. I mean, I enjoyed the ending when I was younger, but yeah, I definitely appreciate it a little more now, especially knowing that those characters were going, you know, transition. They were transitioning, and it's the same sort of thing like breaking away, where they weren't going to be the same group anymore after that moment.
Yeah, and you never know when that's happening until it's over. Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking about that a lot as I was watching both of these. And like I said, that's something that's so universal, and I think it's something we all go through, and you can't help but kind of look back on it with wistfulness. And sometimes a little bit of longing, but, you know, mostly happiness.
Yeah, like they always say, like, one day you won't, you know, go outside and play. And you don't know when that day is going to be, but there will be a day where you won't go outside and play. Same sort of idea, just in a more sort of growing adult kind of way. Like, you know, one day you're not going to hang out with all your friends at once, you know.
One day that's all going to end, and you're not going to know until...
Until
years later that it happened.
Exactly.
So, you know, sometimes even years later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not get too sappy. Let's talk about some trivia.
All right.
Tell me about the trivia on these.
All right. Numbers. Breaking Away. I've got a little more trivia on Breaking Away than Fandango, but we'll get through it. The little 500 bicycle race that forms at the forms the centerpiece of the plot is a real race held annually at Indiana University. A
reenactment felt too specific not to be.
Yeah. A reenactment of the race was staged for the film in the old Memorial Stadium on the IU campus, which was demolished in 1982, just a couple of years later, 4 years after Breaking Away was shot. So the team that won, or whatever, those four guys, is actually based on the 1962 Phi Kappa Psi Little 500 Champions, which featured legendary writer and Italian enthusiast Dave Blaze, who provided screenwriter and fellow Phi Kappa Psi team member Steve Tesh with the inspiration for the main character of the movie. The name of the team manager was Bob Stoller. So Bob Stoller, So it was like Dave Blaze, Bob Stoller, Dave Stoller. So there you go.
It all felt very specific. So that makes sense that it was based on a lot of real events.
Yes. In the real 1962 race, Blaze rode 139 of the 200 laps.
Wow.
Yeah, and was the last person to cross the finish line. In the film, Blaze himself appears in the movie as the race announcer.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah, gave him a little cameo there. Ironically, Dennis Christopher, who plays Dave Stoller, he plays a character fascinated with everything Italian, but Dennis Christopher himself is actually Italian American, and his birth name is Dennis Corelli. So that's why he has such an authentic, like, Italian accent. I can do it so well, I guess. All scenes in the film were shot in and around Bloomington, Indiana, during spring break of 1978. The abandoned limestone quarry where Dave and his friends swam is on private property and is illegal for visitors to trespass. So the rocks used from the limestone quarry, according to, I guess, local people there that were filmed, were used to build the Empire State Building. So
really, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you, man. Indiana limestone is for real. There's Tennessee limestone, but it's not quite as prestigious as Indiana limestone. Just saying. I think the Tennessee state capitol is built from Indiana limestone, if I'm not mistaken. I lost my spot. The production team decided to call the Bloomington Townies Cutters because they felt the actual local nickname, Stoners or Stonies, would draw a parallel to drug references.
Which it would. I mean, it was 79. That was definitely a thing in 79.
Yeah. Dave's bike was a 1978 Mazzi Grand Centurion. So Mazzi was an actual, like, Italian bike manufacturer, but by the 70s, they had moved, somebody had bought them and moved manufacturing to California. So the car that Dennis Quaid drives is a 1970 Buick Skylark. Like I said, the budget was $2.3 million. The gross was $16.4
million. So it was a really successful film at the time.
Yes. Roger Ebert, 4 stars out of 4.
Not surprising. It's a good film.
He says a wonderfully sunny, funny, goofy, intelligent movie that makes you feel as good as a movie in a long time. It is, in fact, a treasure. Movies like this are hardly ever made at all, and when they're made this well, they're precious cinematic miracles.
He is away with words.
Yeah, Rotten Tomatoes, 94% critic score. And audience score, 88%.
Not surprising at all. But this is not a... I have to think nowadays the movie's not really well known.
No.
So I would definitely recommend that people check it out.
The Academy Awards, the Academy, did notice... It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, Best Original Song, but it only won for Best Original Screenplay.
Ah, see, that's a lot of nominations for me not to have ever heard of it before. Even
the Golden Globes nominated for Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best New Star of the Year for what's his name? Christopher? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Dennis Christopher, excuse me. It only won for Best Motion Picture Music or Comedy, or Musical or Comedy. So it is ranked number 8 on the American Film Institute's 100 Most Inspiring Movies of All Time, if you can believe it or not.
I want to say I've looked at that list and just it never registered to me.
Maybe
I just forgot about this film. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I mean, if, yes, you know, go ahead.
I was just saying I'm too busy watching like weird like. You know, horror films and kung fu movies to keep track of some things. Sometimes I think I got too much trash cinema clogging my brain to keep up with some of these more prestigious pictures.
Well, just to go through the top 10 right quick, of the American Film Institute's 100 years, 100 cheers, of America's most inspiring movies. Now, remember, these movies are the ones that are the most inspiring films. Okay. Not really the best, but just the most inspiring. And number one is It's a Wonderful Life. Two is Kill a Mockingbird. Then Schindler's List, Rocky, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, E.T., The Grapes of Wrath, Breaking Away, Miracle on 34th Street, and Saving Private Ryan.
That's quite a list to be included with. That's high praise, yeah.
Yeah, to be in between The Grapes of Wrath and Miracle on 34th Street. So that's what they're saying. Like, this is how, you know, popular, this is how great this movie, you know, really should be or whatever.
Yeah, that's just tell people who've never heard of this film that it's worth checking out. And I definitely think this is one that people should seek out after they listen to the show if they haven't already. But you really should be able to watch these movies before you listen to the show, guys.
Mm-hmm. There was a short-lived TV prequel series based on the film that aired in between 1980 and 1981, and it starred Sean Cassidy as the main character, Dave, but with returning characters of Barbara Bari, who played Dave's mom, and Jackie Hurl Arley, and also Ashton. Who was Ashton? Sorry, going back here. John Ashton's, Mike's brother. From Beverly Hills Cop, John Ashton, they all were in the TV prequel series.
Yeah, I always find TV like spinoffs from movies to be like the weirdest thing.
Especially when you have like the same characters that are in it. I mean, it's so weird.
Yeah.
I remember there was like an Uncle Buck TV like spinoff with Kevin.
There was,
Kevin,
yeah.
Kevin Meaney, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. You are correct.
All right. Anyway, moving on. Fandango. The skydiving sequence in Fandango is shot for shot taken from Kevin Reynolds' USC thesis film called Proof from 1980. Steven Spielberg, that is, you guys, had seen a copy from Proof and offered to produce the project, which became Fandango, and through his company, Amblin Entertainment. So that's why you see Amblin on the credits there. They actually produced the film because of that sequence. So that skydiving sequence is really kind of a short movie in itself. So that's why, to me, it kind of feels like kind of separate, but it still kind of like ties into the story or whatever. Yeah. Kevin Costner actually auditioned and lost the part in the student film for Proof.
Hmm.
You can imagine that. Like, somebody else, I guess, was, you know, better than Kevin. I don't know. The guy that played Dorman, Chuck Bush, the large, mild-mannered schoolmate, he was actually discovered in a 7-Eleven store. He had no prior experience or connection with the movie industry prior to being seen, and he was asked to read for the part.
He's got such a unique look. Like, he's very distinctive.
Mm-hmm. The books that he is reading in the film are Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse, Being Nothing Less by John Paul Sartre, The Prophet by Kali Gibran, and The Incredible Hulk, number 128.
Yeah.
All right. Actors Sam Robarts and Susie Amiss later married in real life.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. In the credits, and then Susie Amiss, I think, became friends with, like, Kevin Costner, and she has credits in, like, other movies as well, like Robin Hood and stuff like that. In the credits, there is a special thanks to the Confederate Air Force who helped the sequence in flying through Dallas, Texas, which is actually Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Confederate Air Force changed their name to the Commemorative Air Force in the year 2000 to not be affiliated with the Confederate States from the United States Civil War. The original name was a tongue-in-cheek name from a fictitious Confederate Air Corps that was sort of dreamed up in 1953. The real CAF, or Commemorative Air Force, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving and showing historical aircraft at air shows in U.S. and Canada. You were saying how much you love that sequence, right? The shot where the police helicopter rises into frame next to the plane. That was a practical effect that was accomplished by parking the plane next to a cliff and then having the helicopter fly below the level of the cliff and then rise into frame.
Well, you certainly can't tell. I mean, that's one thing I love about practical effects and practical filmmaking. Just that ingenuity, and it's seamless because your eye sees it, and it's because it's there, it feels 100% real.
Yeah. But moving on, principal photography began in 1984 at a number of locations, primarily in Texas, including Alpine, Austin, El Paso, Fort Davis, Marathon, Marfa, Monahans, Coyote, Pecos, and as well as Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dom, where Dom was located, was in Big Bend Ranch State Park in Texas. Although Spielberg signed off on it, he was ultimately disappointed with the finished film and did not have his name on the product, just Amblin Entertainment. So, therefore, Fandango did not receive a widespread release. The budget, we don't know, and it only grossed $91,666. Not even $100,000.
Well, yikes. But, you know, like I said, I had only vaguely heard of this movie until you insisted that we watch it. And you've actually been pitching this movie to me for the show since the very beginning.
Yes.
Like, I think in the very first conversations we've had about doing this show, this was a movie that you brought up as something that we should do. And I was just like, we'll get to it eventually. And we finally did, and I'm glad we got there, man, because it's good. It's really good.
Well, we started off the conversations for the podcast of, naming movies that you haven't seen. And, you know, that one to me is always a, like, super obscure movie that everybody that I know that have seen it, loves it, but has a hard time explaining the movie to other people. And it's one of those movies that you just have to watch to really sit and enjoy the characters and enjoy the adventure that they're on. And I'm really glad that you liked it. That's really awesome.
I definitely did. I'm glad to knock that one off the list of shame. And it's one that I would easily recommend to anyone else.
Let me finish. Leonard, I got like three more things, and then we'll be done.
Okay, sure.
Leonard Maltin called Fandango fresh and likable, if uneven. Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah,
it's a little uneven.
Yeah. No Ebert, like, not even on Ebert's radar, basically. Quentin Tarantino was quoted in Empire as follows: "Fandango is one of the best directorial debuts in the history of cinema. I saw Fandango 5 times in the movie theater, and it only played for a effing week. All right."
That sounds like Tarantino for sure. He's passionate, and it is, man. It's a really confident film. It's not perfect. Like I said, it is uneven, but I mean, it's got so many strong sequences and so many nice shots and just a ton of great performances. It's a really, again, I guess it's just a really good movie.
I think it's just capturing, you know what I mean? Like you almost forgive that roughness, for just how capturing it is, I think.
Well, again, because it goes back to, it's basically a hangout movie, just like Breaking Away, where you just enjoy being around those characters.
Mm-hmm.
You enjoy being part of their group and going on this adventure with them. It's enjoyable.
Well, it does have a cult following, which is why it is perfect for our podcast, The Video Culture. On July 2010, fans of the film held a 25th anniversary celebration at some of the filming locations.
So, very cool.
Yeah, I think it was where the Sonic and stuff like that, like whatever town that was in. That they used, because I think it was that was the same town that they used for the final sequence. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. I love watching it. I love watching it again, and you know, I will watch it again and again. So
yeah, because one of the things we wanted to do on this show, as we've talked about before, is keep movies in conversation that we think are worthwhile, that are in danger of being forgotten. And both these films, this episode, feel like that to me. And I'm so glad that we could, you know, talk about them and let people know about them and hopefully get at least one or two people out there to go out and find these and rent them and start streaming them or find DVDs or VHSs of them and watch them, because they're worth rediscovering. They're worth enjoying, you know, even all this time later. And they're really kind of what the show's all about. So,
that question that we always ask, are you going to, be kind and rewind and return it, or are you just going to keep it an extra day?
I think I would keep both of them an extra day. I think I would like to watch them both again, especially Fandango, because now, again, I know how it plays out. Some of the tension I felt watching it initially, with that kind of thought of like that kind of looming fear of like Vietnam and the draft, when you realize it's not a big part of the film, it becomes a little bit more easy to relax and enjoy it than mm-hmm. what it is, and not what you're afraid it might turn into. Because I was afraid it was going to get really dark and somber, and it never really does.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that when it was over with, but it kind of kept me a little bit uneasy for a good chunk of the film before I realized it wasn't going to go that route.
I see. I guess when I saw it as a kid, I didn't think about that. I was just watching whatever was happening, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And I guess I kind of knew kind of how it ended. I do specifically remembered, the ending and just what a great feeling that ending is. And I almost forgot about, to be quite honest, I almost forgot about the flight scene, like jumping out of the plane scene. I almost really forgot about that. But then when they pulled up, I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. You know, so yeah, it's funny.
It is a real highlight of the movie. I mean, it's definitely kind of stuffed inside the film. But it's really just such a fun sequence. And if you don't like anything else about Fandango, you will like the skydiving sequence.
Yeah.
It's just a great little piece of filmmaking. It's fun. It's so well acted. Again, I think both these films are great. I really do.
And let me just say how funny it is that Kevin Costner's next movie was called Silverado. So Fandango, Silverado. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, I would keep both of them. I mean, I would keep them both an extra day. Like I said, I think Breaking Away, I thought initially, you know, I don't know. But then, you know, once you think about it again, it's just fantastic. And I think, yes, you know, the acting is just really, really great. Oh, and that other guy, I failed to mention this too. The other guy that played kind of the antagonist character in Breaking Away. Hart Botcher, he plays Rod. Mm-hmm. I looked at him and I was like, I've seen him before in something. And I was like, I know he's been in something. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. He plays the really kind of sleazy guy in the original Die Hard where he,
wait, he's Ellis.
Yes. He's Ellis from Die Hard.
The Hans Booby guy. Like, yes. Hans Booby.
Yes. Yes.
That blows my mind. So that's a great, yes. That's kind of a great little bit of trivia to end on. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not put that together at all.
Booby.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Totally him. His name is, once again, his actor's name is Hart Botcher.
Yeah, that's definitely his name. I completely didn't.
That smile. Like, he has that unforgettable smile, and you're like, yep, that's it. That's the guy. All right. Suggested movie suggestions. I guess I'll go first. The movie that I thought of when I was watching it is, you know, there's, like I said, there's not a lot of movies that these are like. And the closest movie that I can come up with that I really like is a movie, St. Elmo's Fire. And I know for a lot of people, you know, you've probably seen it. You might have not seen it. It is kind of a Brat Pack movie, but, you know, it does star Judd Nelson, obviously. But I think it's one of those other sort of coming of age films where you have this group of friends and they're dealing with, you know, they're first dealing with, you know, adult stuff, like how to deal with, you know, I just lost my job, or how I deal with divorce, or how I deal with, you know, all this stuff. And they're still trying to keep their kind of like college sort of group together. And it's really almost like falling apart.
So, yeah, I think it would work well as with a paired with Fandango for sure. The movie I'm going to recommend, is related to Fandango, but really has nothing in common with it outside of just like the creative team. Because what I find really interesting was that this was the directorial debut of for feature length for Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner, and those two have worked together a lot since then.
Yeah, so and like they, I mean, all the movies that I mentioned: Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Waterworld. He didn't work on Count of Monte Cristo, but he did. They did work together on that TV series, Hatfield and McCoys.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to recommend was honestly Waterworld, because to me it's fascinating that these two people who made such a small intimate movie could make something so completely differently at their own and have it be just honestly as big a financial failure as Fandango. Because Waterworld was at the time was a huge failure, but creatively it's a much better movie than people give it credit for. And it was just recently re-released on Blu-ray by a company called Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And they put out a really nice box set of it. It's got a multiple different versions of the film, lots of documentaries. And I think Waterworld is ripe for rediscovery. And it's the same creative team behind Fandango. And I think it's just fascinating to see how two people...
The two Kevins.
Who can make two wildly different films.
Yeah. The two Kevins. Kevin Reynolds, Kevin Costner. I know there's always the Hollywood legend that you know, they wanted Kevin Costner to play Robin Hood, so what did they do? They got, you know, Kevin Reynolds to write the adaptation or whatever. Like, that's how they got because I know for a fact that, like, you know, they're really close friends. And, you know, I think that, you know, when Reynolds was sort of down and out, he lived on, you know, Costner's couch and that sort of thing. And, you know, he's like, yeah, he's a great writer. And so it's just, you know, kind of too bad we didn't get to see like his version of Red Dawn or anything. But, you know.
Well, I guess I always appreciate the story of Hollywood types who have true friendships like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I like that about this, that Reynolds and Costner have had this kind of working relationship, this personal relationship for all these decades. To me, I think that's pretty fun and interesting. And it's rare in Hollywood. It truly is.
And I think Waterworld, like you said, got a lot of bad press, you know, from its surrounding, from it being like this, you know, grossly over budgeted, you know, monstrous, you know, film that didn't really like pay off. It was supposed to be this like blockbuster hit. But I mean, it that doesn't really mean that it's, you know, going to be a terrible movie.
And it's really not. I mean, it is a solid like 90s blockbuster. I mean, it's fun and it's enjoyable and it's not nearly the train wreck people want you to believe it is. So that's why, and again, because Fandango was not successful financially and it has the same creative team, I think thematically it'd be really interesting to kind of watch them both for their parallels and their differences.
Well, I think we're just going to have to put Waterworld on our list somewhere, to be quite honest.
We're going to do post-apocalyptic movies at some point. So yeah. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that Mad Max kind of, you know.
Oh, for sure.
Like the world's gone to hell kind of thing. Maybe when the world's in a better place where it doesn't feel so like possible that that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
But anyway, man, I really enjoyed these films. Thank you so much for recommending them. I'm glad we did them. And again, I strongly suggest that everyone listening to this check out, at the very least, Fandango. But if you can, check out Breaking Away as well. You're going to like them. You really will.
Yeah, they're only like $3 to watch, you know, almost anywhere. So there's almost no excuse. And I know you have time, you know, just sitting at home like, what should I watch? There's nothing on Netflix. There's nothing. No, there's movies out there that are completely, completely enjoyable. So I've had a great time. I'm really glad that you like these movies, Matt. And hopefully, next time on our show, we're going to be talking atomic bombs.
Yeah, what a weird change of topics is going to be. But we're going to get into a little bit of history next time.
Yeah, war movies and that are just surrounding war. So,
yeah. Yeah, the kind of war stories that you don't really hear about. But that's for next time on Video Culture. And until then, I'm Matthew Estrey.
I'm Ryan Acree.
Go watch some movies, guys, and stay safe.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us and let's all watch movies together.
Is a stage of growth between infancy and adulthood. In most animals, it occurs during the first year of life. In humans, it happens right after college.
Ah! Innocent critters squashed on the highway alive!
Join 5 best friends on the road.
Are you crazy? Are you out of your mind?
It'll work, Philip.
We're facing imminent death.
It'll be just like water skiing, Philip.
Hey, how are we going to stop?
You are the most irresponsible person I have ever met.
Somebody had to be.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime adventure.
Yes, to us, by God! To us and privileges of you!
Where some will graduate into manhood.
I'm not a weenie.
And others will dive in headfirst.
Hey! Which one of you geeks grabbed the wrong shoe? Who's got my laundry?
We're talking mega malfunction here!
A whole wash day shot to hell.
Fandango.
It's the stuff legends are made of, son.